Hello there, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Sports Pro Podcast. My name is George Breer. I'm head of events content here at Sports Pro. And it feels like it's been so long, I've almost forgotten what they look like. But this week, I'm delighted to say that after a 5 to 6 week hiatus, I'm rejoined in the hot seat by Sports Pro's news editor, Tom Bassam. Tom, the band is officially back together.
You sound extremely excited about this, George. I've been absolutely lapping up your absence, which I'm sure you'll be delighted to hear. Look at his little face. He looks so wounded.
I do, and I feel wounded because the time before that I took an absence, you went for a big hitting interview that I was after. But this time, you went even more aggressive and you only went and spoke to Mr. Gary Lineker in my absence. It's strange that the only week he was available for was the week I went on holiday, but we'll try and bury the hatchet over the next hour or so.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you do insist on having a gap year every 6 months, you are going to miss some things like these that can't be helped.
Well, that's how you keep your insights refreshing on the podcast, Tom, is you've got to find yourself in new environments and rediscover yourself in the rainforests of Vietnam.
Some ayahuasca ceremonies and some full moon parties, I'm sure, were really enlightening.
And no, it's just reading all the sports business outlets a man can get his hands on. But to probably mediate this conversation, I'm also delighted to welcome senior staff writer Ed Dixon onto the podcast.
Good to have you back, George. Thanks for having me. Yeah, the last time you went away, Tom bagged Gary Lineker, and now you're stuck with me. So that's a sobering thought.
Well, speaking of Gary Lineker, another man with some injury problems. Ed, you're banjanks at the moment, am I right? Can't sadly join us in person, so the band is not quite back together.
Sadly not. No, anyone with tips on a dodgy MCL, then by all means get in touch.
And if anyone needs like a translation as to what banjanks means for normal people, I think it's just an injury, but I'm not entirely sure.
Glad it's not just me.
It's onomatopoeic, Tom. You're a writer. You really should know about things like that. Anyway, if our return to the podcast hasn't been as smooth as we wanted, one thing that was smoother than anticipated this weekend was the NFL's debut on YouTube TV and YouTube prime time channels. Now, Tom, as our resident NFL expert, apologies, Chris Stone, if you're listening, how did you find it?
Well, as a viewer in the UK, I was not able to find it at all because it's, of course, an American product. But that's not to say it wasn't a success. So a little bit of background. Google's become the latest broadcast partner for the NFL, maybe its biggest in terms of a technology partner coming into the game. Obviously, Amazon has its Thursday night games, but in terms of like the actual technical operation that Google YouTube has to undertake in order to service its users, it's pretty spectacular. So basically, the Sunday Ticket out-of-market package was a rights package which was previously operated by DirecTV. It's a satellite operation. And essentially what it did was it meant that fans of teams who lived in other parts of the US were able to watch their home team outside of like their local regions, because basically like the territories in the US are broken up based on your local team. So if you're in Chicago, you get the Bears broadcast for free, you get Sunday night football, and you get the afternoon window as well. So that's the sort of the basic level. And that's all on commercial free-to-air TV. So that's NBC, CBS, and Fox. But if you were a Chicago Bears fan and you lived in LA, for example, you had to have this DirecTV out-of-market package in order to watch the Bears, because that's the only way you could pick which game you watched. And for this season, the NFL did a deal with Google worth several billions of dollars. And it means that that package, which was previously a satellite broadcast thing, has now become a streaming product, which lives within YouTube TV, an IPTV service. It's really popular in the US. It's one of the bigger IPTV services. But one of the kind of major complaints about DirecTV was the fact that it was actually quite hard to get, not the most accessible, didn't hold up particularly well, was often just didn't service customers' needs. And in making this switch, in giving Google the rights to stream all of these other games, basically, that fans couldn't watch if they were out of their own market, that's a huge technological undertaking. That's upward of 6, 7, 8 broadcasts at a time. People could choose to quad box those. You can select them. There's just a lot going on there from a technology perspective. So the fact that Google was able to do this, and like seemingly from the reports that have kind of come out of the US, seem to have gone pretty well. A few like moments of disconnection, a few bits of buffering here and there, a couple of jumpy moments. But I mean, you generally get that with a live TV sports streaming experience. It's a very, very tough thing to do from a back end perspective. Yeah, and for it to have gone out without any major blackouts is a pretty major feat for Google, YouTube, and the NFL.
You talked about it moving away from satellite direct TV, and certainly from the bidding that was undertaken last year in the lead up to YouTube winning the tender. It really seemed as if Amazon was the primary competitor there. So from the NFL's perspective, a bit of a double win, the opportunity to use those digital platforms, those streaming services, and reach the audiences that sit within them. But also financially, they saw an uptick. I think it was about $500 million per year. So I think the figure was around 2 to 2.5, reports differ, but it's between that range for a season run fee. So Ed, a bit of a double win for the NFL, would you say?
Yeah, you have to look at the bigger picture here. I mean, ultimately, streaming service worked, shouldn't be particularly newsworthy, but when you factor in, you know, the size of the NFL, the profile of it, its influence in North America, it had to land. YouTube had to hit the ground running. Google, they want to take Sunday Night Ticket and make it more mainstream, you know, to help raise the profile of YouTube TV. You know, so fundamentally, they had to get the basics right. They didn't want to be playing catch up from day one. And you've got to remember that reliability is so highly valued by customers, given the choice that's on offer. If they're going to pay for content, then they want to be able to watch it without a hitch. I mean, things like lowering latency should be a given in this day and age. So YouTube have not dropped the ball so far, and that'll be a relief. And now that they've hit the ground running, they can just go from there.
You say like streaming service doesn't have problems, isn't a news item, but actually, like, the history of this kind of stuff tells us that actually probably is. Like, more of these things fail than they don't, and like, you hear dramatically about the ones that do fail. I mean, I'm thinking about like Optus Sport during the 2018 World Cup,
the Zone in Europe as well,
yeah, especially in Italy. It's not something that I think, like, it's easy to just say, oh, well, that thing happened and that's good. That's actually something that's worth shining a light on and being in praise of. Like, you probably feel like it should be more of a given the size of the companies that we're talking about here, and Google and YouTube and like their own abilities to do these things. But you'd have thought very similar things about other services and products which haven't had that same level of success. So for the NFL, this will definitely be a massive win. And for Google and YouTube, you'd think immediately it looks like it's going to start a deal that's going to start paying for itself.
Tom, it feels almost as if no news has been good news for YouTube and Google for their launch. But you mentioned some of the technological features and the dynamism that a streaming service can offer. I think you use the term quad boxing, which makes banjaxing seem pretty minor in comparison. I'm not going to let you have a response there. Things like multi-view that was introduced for YouTube's March Madness coverage, for instance, has been brought into the Sunday Ticket offering. A positive, but also there was some criticism online that fans weren't able to choose the four games that were selected as part of their multi-view package. And in particular, you know, personalization being pretty much a demand when it comes to those digital services. You'd want that to be in development. But is it a case of start strong and start without those technical glitches and the add-ons, the personalization elements, and some of the more fancy tech capabilities are coming down the pipeline once you can build from a strong base, particularly given recent history with these things?
Yeah, I think it's definitely the latter. Like, make sure you get the core product right first and then add the bells and whistles. It's for a very niche amount of people that will be really looking for, can I select all of these things? Where are all my stats plugins? I don't know, like, even the people that use, say, Amazon Prime Video to watch the Premier League in this country, like, there's loads of features which you can dial into that. But basically, for most people, I'd say probably 80 to 90% of people that use it, you want to make sure that your match broadcast is working and that you can see the games that as you would expect to. I think the other stuff will come with time, and I'd be very surprised if that isn't something that YouTube TV offers and expands into. I think previously when John Cruise spoke at Sports Pro OTT USA earlier this year, that was something that is definitely going to be an offering around that. But for them, it's definitely at this stage getting that core product right.
And Ed, looking a bit more widely, do you think there'll be maybe some execs at the NBA, given the upcoming rights partnership, who might be licking their lips at the success here and seeing, you know, potentially another competitor to come into that rights tender process, and one with a bit of pedigree behind them on the back of this, and really seeing an opportunity to increase the value of those rights with the competition?
Yeah, that is the $1 billion question, or well, potentially multi-billion dollar question if the NBA gets its way. There's been, yeah, as you say, reports that they're looking to create a streaming-only package for their next domestic rights cycle. A lot of names linked. It's actually sort of getting quite difficult to sort of keep up with the latest reports about who's in and who's out. But the NFL is, I guess, with its streaming packages, it's to some extent, I guess, I would say blazing a trail. That might be a bit of a stretch when you look at what MLS is doing. But if you factor in the NFL, MLS and the like, it's showing that, you know, we know stream is the norm. It's more about how leagues are able to carve out those extra broadcast packages to get that extra value that they want and increase revenue from their rights contracts. So yes, they will be watching eagerly, and as will we when we see when it comes up for auction.
Tom, one final note before we move on, but YouTube, you know, we've talked about some of its tech capabilities, you know, with the Google side, but what about from a content point of view? You know, what sort of competitive differentiators do you think that YouTube TV is going to have over the course of the season that other broadcasters aren't able to match?
Well, I think the thing with YouTube TV and like YouTube in general is like that is already a place where you have so many eyeballs going because it offers so many different things. Like, I mean, the NFL, for example, puts all of their like mini highlights packages on YouTube. There's lots of other NFL related content and things. It doesn't even have to be created by official channels for that to be something that's like people are already on the platform for. So I don't know quite how like the interaction works with the IPTV, YouTube TV element of it and the crossover there. But like the fact that you've already got people engaging in that platform, in that ecosystem, I think that's a really interesting avenue for both to explore. What can we do on the YouTube side, perhaps, to get people from looking through your sort of standard sports content that's on there, or even influencer content that's on there, and push them towards this subscription product that people actually pay for? Just to sort of take a massive step back here, the direct TV version of Sunday Ticket was very much a platform for people that had significantly deep pockets, generally older generations of people who were really invested in watching their team when they were out of state. Whereas potentially you could create a marketing stream here in order to translate younger people into your IPTV Sunday Ticket subscription product on YouTube. Look, they're still going to have to pay a lot of money. It's a very expensive product. So it's probably still going to skew older when it comes to that kind of stuff. But just the fact that you are putting it onto a streaming service, you're automatically lowering the age profile which you can attract. So yeah, there's probably a couple of things. It's that additional content side that you can get from YouTube and that funnel. And then there's also the ability to tap into younger audiences and lower the age profile of your customer.
We've already seen with the draft this year, they brought some of their top creators, YouTube brought some of their top creators to the draft. So there clearly is that strategy in place to align, you know, influencer-led or wraparound content with the NFL to bringing new fans into the game, to improving discoverability. So there really does seem as if they get this partnership right, to be a huge runway of opportunity for both the league and for the broadcaster. And that's not really always the case.
No, definitely not. It makes NFL's kind of whole strategy on this look quite shrewd. Like wait and wait and wait, see which streaming propositions are winning and then make the best use of them. I mean, we're talking about this after week one. It may completely nosedive in week two, but if that trajectory continues, then you'd have to look at it and say the NFL have played a blinder.
Especially hedging their bets as well with Amazon on the Thursday night broadcast as well. You really can essentially play them off against each other and see who comes out on top.
Yeah, for sure. I guess the other intriguing aspect of all of this as well is sitting in the background, you've got the NFL Plus. So that is transitioning over from being what was like a mobile product last year, which offers live in-market games, to being something that like is now being expanded onto IPTVs, onto smart TVs, onto those kind of more desktop traditional viewing platforms, as opposed to being a mobile product. There's a few different strands that the NFL is all pulling on at the same time from a tech streaming perspective. That looks like a strong bet. They've got a few different ways in which they can turn and look at the results in a couple of years and figure out which one's the best option for them. I guess the only thing to say on that is that they are locked into very long contracts with all these partners. So figuring those out will be maybe the issue.
Well, I've been saying for a while, but this year is finally the year that I really add the NFL into my Sunday night routine. So we'll be keeping our coverage strong on the podcast as the season develops. Now, Ed, another story that has been rumbling on for some time now, but has finally, it seems, come to an head this weekend, is the controversy surrounding Luis Rubiales at the Spanish Football Federation. Could you run me through the timeline of this story and how we've got to where we are?
As timelines go, it's a pretty depressing one. But in a nutshell, Spain won the World Cup. Very well deserved. And as they came up to collect the trophy, the Spanish Football Federation president, Luis Rubiales, whose conduct during the game from the stands had already been slightly questionable, to put it mildly, he kissed one of the players as they walked past him to collect their medal. She initially put out a statement trying to dispel it. It then emerged that she was perhaps coerced into that. Rubiales has defended his innocence. He's insisted it's consensual, but it then became apparent that Jenny Hermoso said it wasn't. He's been under pressure to resign. There were calls from the government. Spanish players have gone on strike, and he's dug his heels in. His mother even went on hunger strike. So this has been rumbling on for a number of weeks now, getting even more depressing. And now he has finally bowed to the inevitable and resigned. As he's done so, a high court judge has just opened an investigation into him after Jenny Hermoso filed a legal complaint. So yeah, all pretty horrid, really, to put it mildly. I mean, his statement when he did resign, when he gave that interview with Piers Morgan, was, well, made my blood boil, really, to put it mildly. I mean, he said he's protesting his innocence, which he's within his right to do, but it was the one that got me was when he said, "I will defend my honour." Well, I think it's a little far gone for that at the moment, but if he really wanted to defend his honour, it wasn't inconceivable that if he'd held his hands up immediately after the incident, that he could have salvaged something. He may well have been able to have stayed in his job if he'd put his hands up and said, "I've got this completely wrong. It was completely unacceptable." Maybe committed to, you know, various courses, behavioural change, stuff like that. A full investigation into how Spanish football treats female players. There's been criticism that there's an undercurrent of misogyny there, but instead, no, he's put his back's been against the wall and he's dug a hole for himself so deep I can't see him climbing out. But yeah, that's the short abridged history of Luis Rubiales over the last few weeks.
You alluded to it there, Ed, but Tom, it has felt as if that moment where Jenny Hermoso was kissed on the lips after the Women's World Cup final has turned into a flashpoint, an important, I guess, milestone in a review and certainly a period of introspection towards attitudes to women and female workers within the Spanish Football Federation, both on the playing side and on the coaching side. And there have been, you know, various reports that this is a culture that's more widespread than just that one moment. And we heard of the 15 players that refused to play for the national team in the lead up to the World Cup. I think only four of which returned to the eventual squad. What's been your take on that? Do you see this resignation as, you know, another important milestone on that journey? Do you see it as a closing of that chapter? Or do you think it really just needs to be the start of what happens next and a much deeper understanding of the causes and the behaviours that are taking place?
I'd like to think it'd be both a closing of the chapter of that period. This is something we covered on the podcast in the wake of the World Cup, actually, how that win for Spain was sort of done in spite of not just their coach, who everyone seemed to hate, and there's quite unpleasant stories around him too, Jorge Vilda, but also this period for the RFEF. Like, firstly, it's probably fair to say the Spanish FA do invest in their women's team. They have facilities, they have more advantages than, say, a Nigeria or a Jamaica, who were even struggling to get crowdfunding to attend the World Cup itself, right? So we're talking about different levels here. But by that same token, the Spanish football is one of the most developed soccer markets in the world, football markets in the world. And it does seem still to be undervaluing its players, its competition, and aside of that, then as people too. Like, to kind of, for Rubiales, and this is one of the more striking things, I think, in this whole episode, to basically kind of post-truth the whole episode and tell us what we were seeing wasn't what we were seeing, and that this was in some way consensual and that his honour has been damaged by this. Like, I think the only person that's damaged his honour throughout this whole process has been Rubiales himself. I don't know quite how the RFEF, the Spanish FA, moves forward feels like there should be a kind of clearing of the house, a big major overhaul, like a public inquiry, the kind of thing that we would get here. Similar in a way to, and I think this is a comparison that's been drawn quite a lot, the Me Too movement in the US in the wake of Harvey Weinstein and all of those kind of absolutely disgusting charges that he was proven some of which on and some of which weren't. You feel like that kind of has to be, that has to be what happens here in order for it to feel like there's been progress and this hasn't been for nothing. Like, it can't just be the resignation of one man. It has to be a complete change in the culture for that association, but also like maybe I loathe to kind of make too sweeping a judgment about a whole society, but for Spain as a whole to kind of think a little bit more about like the attitudes that allow that to happen, right?
You say that about Spain, but actually Women in Football, they've published a report that said, I think the 2023 figure for women working in football, 82% of those people have reported experiencing discrimination in the workplace. Not only is that a staggeringly high figure, even more concerning, that's more than a 15% jump from the 2020 figure, which was at 66%. So it's seemingly not just an endemic problem across football, but one that's on the rise as well.
Yeah, and look, there's always varying reasons why that's the case. Like, I don't want to kind of generalize and get too deep into those numbers and try and find explanations for them, but like, you'd like to think hopefully there's a change in culture that makes people feel a little bit more comfortable in reporting that as well. So I think while that's definitely bad, there's an increased reporting in numbers, the fact that people probably feel more comfortable reporting them is also something that should be viewed positively. Look, I'm like, speaking as not a woman, none of us on this pod, right, are in the best place to comment on this from that perspective. That's not to say that we can't impact change in some way in the way that we act about anything in relation to like our colleagues or the way we talk to our friends about this kind of stuff. I think all of it comes from it takes a church, right, to kind of impact the whole thing. It takes a whole group of people to say, actually, this isn't right. And unfortunately, in this case, it's come at the expense of what should have been like a crowning moment for these Spanish women's players. But hopefully it brings about that positive change in that this isn't something that we're having to talk about again, at least not to this kind of scale, or at least not in this high profile way. It'd be great if we moved on to battling smaller fires in this case. Instead, it looks like we've got a big raging wildfire.
You know, speaking of that big raging wildfire, what do you think is next for the Spanish Federation?
They've got an interim president right now. I'll be honest, I don't know a lot about him. The fact that it's a him probably says that some of this change will be not as dramatic as we'd want it to be. Maybe there's an election, and maybe there's a change there again. The coach has already gone. All of his staff have already gone. I think what has to happen is, like, at least for the Spanish FA, is that when it comes to the women's team, it's probably time to listen to them and hear what they want and make decisions based on that. Because ultimately, these are the people that are impacted. And that's been the kind of sad case throughout, as I said before. Like, those people are the ones that have had to suffer through this. Luis Rubiales isn't a victim here. Those players that won the World Cup are the victims, and that is really sad. So, yeah, I think whatever change happens and whatever happens next, it should be not put on them to make the decision, and not like it's up to you or it's like this rests on you, but there should be so much more consultation and listening done, I think.
Yeah, as you say, I think, Ed, you mentioned this as well. 81 players had withdrawn or made themselves unavailable for selection whilst he remained in post, but I think more than a week passed since that announcement was made and an action from the Rubiales side. Instead, it was an interview with Piers Morgan, which I think says quite a bit as well.
Yeah, very, very odd for a president of a national like governing body to go to another country to speak to someone in another language, in another industry, to speak to them about that. Like, the communication levels here have been like abysmal. I guess the other thing to say as well is that, like, ultimately, the Spanish men's team did come out and offer their support to the women's team, but it took them a very long time. There was a couple of handful of players, some that you'd expect, like Hector Bellerin, who's been a well-known advocate of women's rights and women's football, but a little bit too quiet, I think, from quite a lot of those Spanish players, whose voices are important. And sometimes they don't realise it, sometimes they don't want that responsibility, but it seems unfair that the women have to do all their own talking for them.
Now, I want to take a quick break from some of the news stories that have been doing the round to talk about Ignition, Tom. So Ignition is SportsPro's sports technology arm, I guess. A virtual event taking place at the beginning of October. Tom, do you want to talk to me a little bit about Ignition and what it's doing?
Yes, it's now going to be the third edition of Ignition. And basically, it's an incredible meeting point for the sports world and the technology world, especially the kind of the startup space where there can be a little bit, I think, of a gap. And what this event does is look to kind of fill that and bring together partners. Like, it's something I feel like, I mean, we spent the first 15, 20 minutes of this podcast talking about technology and sports and the pitfalls that you get there. And when it comes to that, this is the place for those two things to come together. And this year's agenda looks to hit on kind of five key themes: fan engagement, in-venue tech, commerce tech, data analytics tech, and then media tech, which is something I think we're probably a little bit more regularly talking to on this show and on the Streamtime podcast as well, whereas those other ones can be a little bit overlooked. I don't know, George, if you've got any insights into some of the speakers that we've got for Ignition this year.
Yeah, it's an exciting looking list. I'm also really interested to hear some of the topics that I've been hearing around the office that are going to be covered. You know, the buzzword on everyone's lips, AI as well, but in particular looking at all of the different ways in which it can be applied within sports, both to immersive experiences, to managing internal workflows, but also from a content creation standpoint. I'm really excited to see some actual tangible examples and not just ChatGPT for the podcast. Hey, Tom. Also looking at immersive experiences, I'm really excited to be sitting down with Anne Detlefson, who's the Senior Director of Digital and Emerging Content at the PGA Tour, on their recent partnership with Roblox. Still, the jury's out whether I'm going to be tempted to download the game and have a quick go, but I'll see if I can do that on company time. Again, just joking. And lastly, connected fitness. So looking at, you know, we often cover the, I guess, the non-physical side of sport, shall we say. So I'm looking forward to adding that string really to the bow of the topics we traditionally cover, and looking at some of those companies, you know, you look at someone like Whoop or you look at someone like Peloton and how they're essentially going to redress the balance that they've seen recently. You know, they've had some staff layoffs, for instance, but how they're sort of poised for the next generation. So lots to look forward to. It's taking place on the 4th of October, I believe. So yeah, looking forward to it.
One other thing we should just mention about that as well is the Ignition Innovation Competition, which opens on the 4th of October too. Applications close for that on the 15th of December. The winners for that will be announced in the new year. I should mention a couple of previous winners we've had on that have been incredibly successful in the sports space. Slate, who do incredible stuff on the social media side, work with a number of teams on enlivening those up, and also SportsPro 2 and Scoreplay, who were last year's winners, who, again, in that kind of social media space and just make using content and capturing content and storing content and getting it into the right places a hell of a lot more easier. And as someone that uses both of those platforms regularly as part of my workflows, couldn't speak highly enough about them.
Last year's winner and last week's podcast. So if you do want to hear more about Scoreplay, do head to the feed and tuck in. Now, speaking of tucking in, my week started, Ed Dixon, with a devouring of a long form piece on 10 years of Thomas Bach's rule at the IOC. How did you find writing that piece? And can you give me a little bit of background on what it was?
Yeah, it's something that we've been discussing doing in the team for, well, since we all clocked that it was 10 years of Thomas Bach. Yeah, so it's been in the works for a number of months, involved a lot of emails, a lot of planning. But yeah, no, it was very interesting to put together. We got quite a broad range of people who've worked with Thomas Bach, people who have perhaps not his biggest fans, on and off the record. So the idea was to create quite an objective sort of balance piece and just give a flavor of what has gone on in his tenure. Just, you know, it's not a timeline, it's not exhaustive, because it would be even longer if you can imagine it, more just to provide a snapshot into an insightful snapshot, I should say, into his role and what the key sort of the biggest developments have been and what's to come.
Like, Ed, I think it's fair to say, and you referenced it there, that he is a bit of a polarizing figure. I think that's probably the case for quite a lot of people that lead major, not just sports organizations, but organizations generally. It's always kind of interesting to compare the overall feeling or sentiment towards the FIFA president and the IOC president, two people that generally tend to upset a lot of people. It's not to say that Thomas Bach hasn't had some wins during his time leading the IOC. There has definitely been some positive changes. What would you say were like the bigger wins that he's had in that 10 years?
Well, yeah, I mean, to your point about him being a polarizing figure, I think it's worth mentioning that, you know, as IOC president, he has to be a lot of things. You know, one day he's a deal negotiator, and you know, the next day he's a statesman, and then after that he's even a confidant. So he has to be a lot of things, and he is a lot of things. People I spoke to, descriptions of him range from sort of more politician than multi-sport leader to, you know, very much the man in control, high energy, well informed. Somebody described him something else, but I won't repeat that. But yeah, don't want anything libel. In terms of wins, if we go to the commercial aspect, if we just dive straight in there, I mean, the top program's in good shape. He's added a lot of brands. I mean, it hasn't really changed dramatically since it was introduced in the mid-80s.
For those that may not be aware, can you quickly give an overview of the top program, what it is?
Yeah, so it's an abbreviation of the Olympic Partner Program, so top program, and it's where the IOC's, well, clues in the name, top partners, almost premium sponsors, if you like, all sit. And there is different inventory that sits within that. So it came into effect in, I think it was 1985. And then since then, so it now sits at 14 brands. So just reeling off some of the ones that have been added since Bach's come in: Airbnb, Alibaba, Allianz, Intel, Deloitte. So he's added a lot of brands. I think if, I know we're going to sort of maybe go two sides of the coin and maybe go into some of the areas where he maybe hasn't performed as well as he would have liked, there have been some critics that think he maybe should have evolved the program. Is it maybe focusing on activations that attract more younger consumers, things like that. I think also another highlight has been the NBC deal, the multi-year TV rights deal that runs until Brisbane 2032. That's worth what's 7.65 billion. I mean, that's been the biggest under his tenure, and it was signed in 2014, and that has actually kicked off what was a pretty good first year from a commercial standpoint, being able to lock that in. I mean, he may have been tempted to go, you know, maybe take more short term, maybe look to have got more money, albeit on a short term basis, but that's now become huge. You know, it's fundamental to the IOC to have this huge contract, given how the media landscape is almost unrecognizable. I guess if you're to look beyond the commercial aspect, he's looked to change the Olympic bidding process. He felt it sort of asked too much too soon. So he's created this dialogue phase, required host cities to present sort of an Olympic project that sort of matches their sports, economic, social, long-term planning needs, stuff like that. I mean, overall, what he's tried to do is he's tried to make the games a more attractive, economically viable proposition for hosts. So, you know, they will have more to choose from, essentially. It's up for debate if he's succeeding that. But it's an understatement to say that his tenure has been instant packed. I think it's probably fair to say a lot of leaders would have resigned or over less. I mean, he managed to ensure Tokyo 2020 wasn't called off completely. You know, he managed to keep the ball in the air long enough until the Japan suggested a postponement or put forward a postponement. And crucially, his power hasn't been diluted. He's still as influential as ever. You sort of think after 10 years, you know, other people may have chipped away at him, but from what I've gathered, he's very much the guy steering the ship and setting the agenda. I mean, whether you think he should be more accommodating in terms of his leadership style is up for debate, but he's done a lot and he's still got a lot planned before 2025.
Yeah, I think there's some really interesting things to go into there. The criticisms of the top partner program, I mean, sponsors are sponsors at the end of the day. I know that's probably not what some people who work in the industry want to hear, but he got big deals done and like that's kind of the job.
Ruthlessly commercial of you, Tom.
Yeah, well, almost just ruthlessly dismissive of, I think, something that can sometimes be a little bit overcomplicated. But like things like Airbnb, for example, have interesting things that they can do with their partnership, and there's aspects there which work well with host cities, and perhaps like that bit's, that's an interesting avenue that hasn't been fully explored, I don't think, yet at any games in particular. And then also Alibaba, it's not like a well-known tech brand in the West, but what we're talking about there is essentially a superpower in terms of like cloud computing and all of that kind of stuff. So those aren't insignificant deals, and those do things which set up the IOC pretty well. And you'd have to say that he looks like he's come out on the right side of the NBC deal as well. Like NBC as a broadcaster hasn't managed to make the best out of the Olympics that it's been able to broadcast under that deal, but they're still locked in for a number of years. And actually, they've always been kept on by the promise of the LA 2028 games, which is coming up soon, and where they'll be the big dog. I mean, it's not that they aren't the big dog. They are definitely the biggest dog when it comes to the broadcast deals for the IOC. But so far, their sort of financial commitment hasn't probably quite met the levels of returns when it comes to at least eyeballs. I think advertising's been fine, but it's not. There's definitely a sense that, for at least from a commentary perspective, that the Olympics has become a bit of a not quite an albatross, but certainly a little bit of a ball and chain for NBC when it comes to their summer programming. And those are definitely wins for Back. Like, those are deals that he was in charge of. And as you say, Ed, no one's chipping away at his power. That's not to say he's wholly deserving of praise. There are definitely holes in his tenure.
Ed, when you were talking to people about the broadcast landscape, in particular the NBC deal and the one broke with the European Broadcast Union as well, both locked in until 2032. That was also against the backdrop of the launch of the Olympic Channel in 2016, now Olympics.com. What were you hearing when it comes to his legacy, the IOC's sort of owned and operated channels, I guess, and setting up that additional media outlet? Was that seen as a success, as a sort of a particular mark innovation?
They had to launch a streaming product. I mean, that's a given. I think that the purpose of it is to try and ensure that, you know, interest in the games exists year round. It's not confined to a 1 month period every 2 to 4 years, if you include the winter and summer games. Has it been a success? I mean, it's there. It's primarily there to make sure that, you know, to get young people in, because they're not going to wait 4 years now to look at the games. And is it a success? I suppose one way of looking at it is, are people talking about the games in a good way beyond the actual event itself when it takes place? As in, you know, oh, did you see X in competing in whatever, you know, in the build-up to the games or something like that? So no, they're not really. I think the only time we really hear about the games, or the average Joe does, is usually when something's bad's happened, and a lot of that has happened. So it's less about stuff when they do hear about the games. It's less about stuff that's actually happening on track or on field, and actually sort of some of the other developments that are taking place on it, which, as we'll get to, are not, perhaps not the most positive. So it's, I think, to be honest, I know it sounds a bit of a cop-out, I think it's too early to say. I know it launched in 2016, the Olympic Channel, but it's still taking shape. I think they're still working out how best, where it sits within the wider IOC ecosystem, if you like. I mean, it's important in a sense, particularly for top partners, because they want to have extra reach and platform and these platforms in place so that they can make better use of their sponsorship. So they want to be able to have more opportunities to use the Olympic brand. So that's where the Olympic Channel does come in. But it's still developing, and I think it's still finding its feet, albeit, what, 6-7 years on.
I think we'll come to talk about Russia, which I think is probably a whole thing in and of itself. But what do you see as like the detracting factors on his tenure? What's really not gone well for Back during those his 10 years in charge?
Well, he hasn't really had a quote-unquote normal games, really. I mean, Sochi 2014, I know that was selected before he came in, but it was shockingly expensive. And then, of course, the state-run doping program emerged. So you move on to 2016, let Rio, that was considered by some people to be quite amateurish in the way it was run. Some labeled it a financial disaster. Pyeongchang showed us the tensions between North and South Korea. And we all know what happened with Tokyo 2020. So hosting has clearly been a problem. And I know all of those were named as co-hosts prior to his election, but the first one he did name under his tenure was Beijing 2022, and that was just completely engulfed in conversations around China's alleged human rights violations. And we even saw some countries declare diplomatic boycotts. So, you know, I think the manner in which he's responded to criticism has proved divisive, and I think that kind of comes from him perhaps treating the IOC more as kind of a multinational company, which is reflected in its commercial deals, rather than the United Nations of Sport has been described that under some of his predecessors. And another issue as well is the Winter Olympics. I mean, it's hardly spoiled for choice with bids for future editions. And of course, it's particularly vulnerable to climate change. So that's other things to consider as well. And, you know, I don't want to make this exhaustive, but I think another key issue that has rather sort of underpinned, well, followed back throughout the last 10 years is political neutrality. I mean, the IOC still clings to that, but it's difficult because he's made big efforts to strike good relationships with political leaders, and you could easily view that as a political act. The IOC would argue you have to keep less, shall we say, palatable world leaders on side, but and the world is now in a place where political diplomacy has to be a component of any major sports organization, but it is getting increasingly difficult to see how the IOC can still sort of have this political apathy considering everything is going on. And then of course there's, you know, other issues like athlete welfare. A lot of athletes still feel they're not being treated fairly. They want to be equal partners. A lot feel they still aren't. You have to look at Rule 40 and Rule 50 in the IOC's charter, which, if you don't know, they dictate athlete marketing and political expression during the games. There have been some measures put in place to sort of allow athletes a little bit more leeway, particularly with marketing during the games, to mention their sponsors. But, you know, the criticism against Bach there is that he's been reactive to athlete pressure rather than proactive, which has left them feel marginalized. I mean, they do have more representation, but a lot of athletes still felt that they're not getting the support they want. And if they do get any from the IOC, it's often too little, too late.
I think you're right in highlighting the hosting side of this. I mean, as you said, though, he only was overseeing a process which picked Beijing and Pyeongchang. Were those the only ones he picked? Or was it just Beijing?
No, he didn't pick Pyeongchang, he only picked Beijing.
That to me, in a way, is kind of, I mean, maybe that's, it's, it tells two stories, doesn't it? I think Beijing was the first city to host both the Winter and the Summer Games, which again talks to that sustainability point and how much longer that's going to be viable. But also the fact that after such a tumultuous period of selecting hosts, where you went to Russia twice off the back of going to Beijing in 2008, which obviously he wasn't in charge of, but you then pick to go back to one of the more contentious states on the roster of major Olympic potential host cities. I think as well, he's been seen as hiding behind neutrality when it comes to some of this stuff too. So Russia, I think, is the thing we should probably get on to talking about next, and maybe now's the right time to do it. Like, it seems crazy to me that you go from his first games in charge at Sochi, where there's a state-run doping system designed to deliver an absolute bucket load of medals, which it did successfully. That's later exposed. And the levels of details to which like come out about that system are mad, with holes in the wall and like James Bond levels of spying and urine swapping and all of this kind of stuff. For then Russia to be like afforded this odd semi-member status, still involved in the games, still really dictating the narrative around the whole games as well. Kind of like, okay, you can be neutral, but actually what is neutral when it's like you're not defending your organization because of your desire to stay neutral in the argument.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, let's get on to Russia. I mean, the IOC is a global organization, and it takes a global view. Our criticism obviously comes from a Western angle, but I think Russia is the one where it feels like public opinion is overwhelmingly against Thomas Bach. I mean, it is, as one person I spoke to described it as the elephant in the room. You know, his legacy is still to be truly defined, but Russia is going to be absolutely crucial to how that eventually plays out. I mean, there's been so much back and forth since it was November 2015. WADA made the accusation of the program. So the IOC rejected WADA's recommendation. So WADA's recommendation, I should say, to ban Russia for Rio 2016. As you say, they then competed with a reduced number of athletes. The IOC then did eventually ban them in 2017 from Pyeongchang, but the clean athletes could compete under a neutral flag. Russia then got hit with a four-year ban. It was then reduced by CAS, but still keeps them out of Tokyo 2020 and Beijing 2022. But again, they can compete under the Russian Olympic Committee flag. And then, of course, this has rumbled on for years. And then any hopes of a solution have then effectively been absolutely flattened by the invasion of Ukraine. The IOC, to its credit, it did come out for an international event ban on athletes from Russia and Belarus. But since then, as the war has unfortunately dragged on, more countries are supporting the Ukraine stance in banning Russian and Belarusian athletes from Paris 2024. And the IOC, it's less than a year out now, they're still to make a decision. Bach's denied using stalling tactics, but I get the impression that he is, much like he did with Tokyo 2020, he is going to wait until the last possible moment before making a decision. But the longer he leaves it, the more the pressure is going to be ramped up. But this is where his, you know, he's a lawyer. This is where his skills are going to really be put to the test.
A fencer and a lawyer. I think the sort of disaster scenario here is where you end up with countries supportive of Ukraine, including Ukraine, boycotting a games in a state which has, well, a state which is arguably on their side in France, but because of the fact that the organisers won't stop another country from competing. Like the fact that the presence of Russia at the Games could prevent those other countries which are not currently being invaded by Russia from competing seems absurd to me, and I think would seem absurd to most observers, apart from, it seems, Thomas Back. So, yeah, I think if we're going to start talking about legacy, and that would be an interesting place to go on this, like that will no doubt be the thing that I think he's remembered for. And it could cloud whether or not, and probably will cloud whether or not people view the end of his tenure as if he's leaving the IOC in a better position than when he took over its leadership.
If you're going to think bigger picture, you know, I mentioned with the NFL YouTube stuff, you know, thinking bigger picture, you know, Thomas Bach's trying to keep the Olympic movement together. He's trying to keep all federations together. And that's why, you know, the IOC has issued, suggested gradual return of Russian athletes to sports after many IOCs banned them. But he's trying to keep the Olympic movement together. His time frame for decisions, it's not even for Paris 2024. It's years and years and years ahead. He wants the Olympic movement to still be in place and for it to have that same heft long after he's gone. So it's a different viewpoint than it is informing his thinking. You may agree or disagree with whether that's the right course of action, but that's what's informing his thinking. And it's making a lot of countries unhappy, but that is why he's doing what he's doing. You know, he's got to get Russia sorted, and there's so much out of his control. He's going to be annoying somebody no matter what he does, but he's thinking, clearly thinking long term here. But there will come a point where he has to make a decision that is just going to be isolated to Paris 2024. When that comes, we'll have to see.
And Ed, just to sort of to finish it off, you've talked a little bit about his legacy and whether or not this will be one of the defining decisions that he makes. Did you get the impression from those you spoke to, and also yourself from the research you've done, that he'll be leaving the IOC in a better place than he's found it?
It's going to be in a different place. As I said, Paris 2024 will say a lot about his legacy. Yeah, it's the first on paper that looks like it'll be comparatively uncontroversial. Of course, there's the Russia issue as well. He's got to come down on the fence somewhere. But, I mean, he's definitely tried to further professionalise the IOC, make it more efficient. As I said, he's overhauled the bidding process. The marketing and media platforms have grown. So I think it seems weird because he's due to step down in 2025. So he's still got a fair amount of time left. And I don't want to speculate too much, but it's not unfeasible that he tries to angle for an extension beyond 2025. I think it's unlikely, but it's not completely impossible. So if he does go, he'll certainly have a say on who replaces him. So his legacy will be efforts to further professionalize the IOC and make it more of a commercial behemoth. Now, the flip side of that is, has he neglected other things in his pursuit of that? Do athletes feel more included? A lot would say they aren't. Have other fundamentals of the Olympic Charter been more closely adhered to? And I know it's a global organization and we'll have that worldview, but some of the choice of hosts are going to have divided, and there's still people incredibly annoyed that the Olympics went there. Yes, it's the IOC's mandate is to go to take the Olympics to the world. And we can't always look at things through a Western lens, but there are fundamentals of what the Olympics stand for, and certain things that we've seen in the likes of Russia, in the likes of Beijing, just seem to be completely at odds with that. So, you know, it's probably not a very insightful thing to say, but, you know, some good, some bad, and there's still a long way to go before we can paint a full picture on what Thomas Bach's legacy is. And we'll also have a better idea, I think, of when his successor comes in and who that is, and how the Olympics fares in terms of picking new hosts and how they perform going forward.
As your answer suggests, and as you've referenced, he is a polarizing figure and one that, you know, it's certainly not a straightforward picture when analyzing the last 10 years of his presidency. I think your opening line for the piece, which I loved, was a general rule of life is to play the hand you're dealt. In the case of Thomas Bach, the latest decade has seen the IOC stick, twist, and in some cases go all in. And if that doesn't titillate your interest to go and take on the piece, I'm not sure anything will. Well, Tom and Ed, I think we are out of time for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Ed, in particular, with your knee, thanks for taking the time to run us through your piece and for sharing your thoughts. And Tom, it's good to be back.
It's good to be back, mate. We'll be back in here next week, I think.
Thanks, Ed.
Cheers, gents.